guess that we have a lecture in two parts. The first part is actually a lecture. The second part is a to-do list, because you'll be drinking from a fire hose. Things will be coming fast and furious, and although maybe the first part of the lecture expects you to get and to treat as a regular lecture, there'll be several things to work on for the next few years, because we're in the third generation of innovation in psychopharmacology now. At least that's how I see it, where we went from the old antipsychotics to the new antipsychotics and SSRIs, and then things fizzled out. And now it's a very exciting time. But it's going to take a lot of new learning in order to master two things: this group of treatment-resistant depression drugs, which I'm not going to talk about here in this lecture, and all these new drugs that are going to be coming with brand new mechanisms we've never had for 70 years. Hey, if you only have to do this to-do list every 70 years, it's not that bad, right? So we're going to talk about new targets, and really it's about the psychosis circuit. So these are disclosures. Any questions, you can ask me about those. Learning objectives of this lecture are to, first, we're going to go through the old stuff, describe quickly the limitations with the first and second generation so-called antipsychotic medications. I don't actually like calling them that. I like calling them medications with antipsychotic actions, because you know the so-called antipsychotics actually are used more for non-psychotic indications, so it's kind of a crazy term, but I think you know what I mean. And we're going to identify clinical data on novel and emerging pharmacologic agents for the treatment of schizophrenia. But that's not enough, because if I just told you what they did and told you what they were, that's not sort of the NEI or the stall way of doing things. Well, I want you to understand it. If you really begin to get the excitement for the neurobiology behind this stuff, it'll really motivate you to understand more about psychosis and understand where to put this into the landscape of your patients with psychosis. But it is not going to be done at the end of this lecture, so don't put that on your burden. I don't expect you to remember everything or to understand everything, but I want you to go from the first stage of learning to the second stage of learning, at least. And what's that? Well, perhaps you walked in here and you weren't aware of what I'm going to be saying in the second half of my lecture. You had ignorant bliss. In other words, you didn't even know you didn't know it. If all that happens is that you go to the next stage of learning, which is you say, oh my God, now I know I don't know it, that's enough, because it gives you a to-do list of things to knock down at next year's Congress or the various ways that we're going to try to get this, and we're very dedicated in rolling this information out to you and repeating it in ways in which is fun, but also empowering. So then we're going to describe the novel therapeutics from pharmacotherapies to address unmet needs, and this is a schizophrenia talk, including residual symptoms, functional impairment, med side effects, okay? So the shift, oh my God, from old to new ways of, did I wake you up? Thinking about the neurocircuitry of schizophrenia, there was actually a very cool lecture that our colleague and friend Madhukar Trivedi gave the other day on the same topic. We're not talking about synapses anymore. We're not even talking really about receptors anymore. We're talking about nodes in networks. And if the one thing you get out of this lecture and others here is that we've gone away from receptors and synapses, and we're thinking of circuits, and there's now not a psychosis neuron and a psychosis receptor, mesolimbic dopamine hyperactivity D2 receptors, that's so 1980s. We're now talking about that being a single node, but the way the new drugs work is at a different node in the same network. So you can affect a whole network by any node in the network, and that's what we've discovered for new drug development. And that's why an acetylcholine node in the network with dopamine hyperactivity can manipulate the dopamine. That's why a trace amine node in a dopamine network can change dopamine with never talking directly to dopamine. And that's the secret to making drugs with new mechanisms. So dopamine psychosis, schizophrenia, just to review that quickly, the dopamine hypothesis is still alive. We haven't killed that. You can actually have human PET scans that prove that hyperactive dopamine pathway, you can actually see it in living human beings with PET scans. There's too much dopamine coming out of the dopamine neuron in this pathway. That's still true. Everything I say doesn't change this. And we do believe the opposite's true in certain other pathways that go to the cortex. And those are now the negative cognitive affective symptoms of psychosis. Okay, this hasn't changed. So here it is, the dopamine neuron, but I begin to play the game. There are three other neurons. I'm beginning to draw in a psychosis circuit. Hold on to your seats because it's not this simple, but now there's four nerves, there, not one. And what do we think? We think that psychosis is possibly a neurodevelopmental abnormality, and the hypothesis is it specifically lives at the connection between a glutamate and a GABA neuron in your cortex. And the N-methyldiaspartate synapse that's receiving the glutamate from the first orange nerve talking to the purple one, it ain't working right. So that nerve, some places it actually goes away. There's some degeneration of it, but certainly it's not functional, we think. This is the leading hypothesis. Again, maybe we'll change this in 20 years, but this is what we're saying now. So that doesn't work. So if the GABA neuron doesn't work, what's going to happen to the third nerve if it's no longer inhibited by the purple one? Boom! It's going to be activated. And that sucker's going to go down and kick the butt of that dopamine neuron, and that's why dopamine is high. There's nothing particularly wrong with the dopamine neuron. It's just being overactivated because of the loss of that glutamate synapse, which causes downstream glutamate hyperactivity. So you'd say, well, Stahl, we better make something for targeting the NMDA receptor in the cortex. We have done that. We failed. It doesn't work. We don't know how to do that yet. Still working on that. That could be the case. So what else are we going to do? Well, let's block the hell out of the blue dopamine cloud, so much so that you have extrapyramidal symptoms and all sorts of weight gain and everything else. That's good. That's what we've been doing for 70 years. There may be alternative ways of doing that because dopamine is too high in psychosis, and of course, this is a parallel pathway. There's another set of glutamate neurons that go south down into the brainstem, but they talk to a different set of dopamine neurons that actually, in this case, has a little purple thing in the brainstem that the other ones lacked. So what does that do? It changes the polarity so that when you have your hypofunctional synapse and the purple one dies or doesn't work right, and you have hyperactivity just as before, it's actually going down to a purple one to activate it so that it actually does what? It inhibits. And that's why dopamine is low, we think. So this is beginning to understand psychosis circuits coloring in glutamate and GABA with dopamine. But I'm not done. First generation antipsychotics, quickly, we thought that they blocked D2 receptors and that that antagonism worked for positive symptoms but caused side effects, like if you're dark, you know, too much zoned out zombie would make you have new negative symptoms on top of the ones the disease caused, increase your prolactin, motor side effects, EPS, tardive dyskinesia. And so additional drugs may help a little bit, but, you know, not much. So then this D2 antagonist, as you've seen, was added to a 5-HT2A D2 antagonist that was called second generation. And there were some that were 5-HT1A partial agonists with some D2 partial agonism and some 5-HT2A antagonism. That was another class of drugs. And then there was even a class of drugs that were just pure 5-HT2A antagonists. I'm going to draw in the next generation of psychosis circuits now. Because the second generation antipsychotics were an attempt to prove the efficacy and tolerability. They did nothing to improve the efficacy, did they? Maybe with clozapine, but not, I mean, are the second generation any better than the first? I don't think so. Are they more tolerable? Well, they're different tolerable, aren't they? Overall, probably more motor tolerable. Some people thought that this would actually improve negative symptoms, but it didn't really. The one thing is that it probably didn't cause them to get much worse, but I don't think it improved them at all. But it did improve motor side effects because you didn't have the same amount of drug-induced Parkinsonism and the need for anticholinergics of the second generation. And most of them had less hyperprolactinemia. But that's pretty modest in terms of an improvement. It didn't revolutionize, although we think in balance, these things are probably better to use than the first generation. I work for the California Department of State Hospitals. We use a lot of first generation antipsychotics because they work. So here's the psychosis pathway shown a little bit differently. There's your famous glutamate neuron I've already shown you. I've left out the GABA one talking to it because I want to emphasize some serotonin. Do you know that a serotonin neuron comes up and talks to that at the top there, the 5-HT2A, and it excites it? So when the 5-HT talks to the GABA or the glutamate neuron, it'll excite it and make dopamine come on downstream. And if you don't believe me, take a dose of psilocybin. What's psilocybin? Artificial 5-HT2A agonist. It's serotonin at that very same receptor. So if you want to know how psilocybin works, I just showed you. It goes down and kicks the butt of the dopamine neuron. But if you take a 5-HT2A antagonist, whether that's, you know, pimavanserin in Parkinson's disease, or actually, if you want to reduce hallucinations caused by psilocybin, give an antagonist to 5-HT2A, and you will actually make those hallucinations go down. Here's another thing. What if you raise serotonin itself at this thing, and it goes down to another neuron? This is a different glutamate neuron. Have you ever given an SSRI and had this happen? Glutamate's activated. This neuron pathway is activated. Dopamine goes down and you get flat affect. That's how it happens. When that pathway is activated, you get blah. Patients do that all the time with SSRIs, haven't they? Have you seen that? That's the mechanism of that. And so it's possible that 5-HT2A antagonism, in part with our new generation medications, the second generation, and other ways, this is maybe one of the reasons all that works a bit in the depression indications, those drugs that have 5-HT2A antagonism that are so-called antipsychotics. If they do this, they're going to do this, and dopamine's going to go up, and you're going to have an improvement of that. So the 5-HT2A antagonism in this pathway may be partially responsible for antidepressant or at least mood elevating effects. Now we move into the to-do list part of my lecture. Newer drugs for psychosis, at least in the second generation, had 5-HT2A antagonism, mostly with, but sometimes without D2 antagonism. Some of them had 5-HT1A partial agonism or D2 partial agonism. I just showed you how 5-HT2A antagonist may have efficacy for psychosis, at least the kind of psychosis that psilocybin causes, and also reduce side effects in some cases. And the partial agonists have efficacy with side effects, you know all this stuff. And so the partial agonist spectrum I'm going to show you here goes from full agonist on the left to an inverse agonist on the right with an antagonist in the middle. And within the partial agonist rainbow spectrum, you've got the neurotransmitter itself is a very full agonist. They always are full agonists. But the 5-HT1A parts of the so-called antipsychotics are almost agonists, almost full agonists. And the D2 agonists that are used for Parkinson's disease are almost full agonists. There are D2 agonists for that. Pramipexole, et cetera, right? Then you have D2 partial agonists that are almost antagonists. They make Parkinsonism worse and help psychosis because they're almost antagonists. Then you do have the antagonists and you have the 5-HT2A antagonists. So the partial agonism is that one of the things I didn't tell you is every time you have a neuron with a 5-HT2A receptor on the top, you've got a 5-HT1A receptor in the bottom. Serotonin 2A receptors are always excitatory. Serotonin 1As are always inhibitory. So if serotonin goes into this receptor, glutamate's going to be inhibited, glutamate cloud will go down, GABA inhibition will go away, you will disinhibit, that's a fancy way of saying turning on, dopamine release. So we think that the 5-HT1A partial agonism may help a little bit for negative symptoms of schizophrenia, but they certainly are responsible for some of the antidepressant effects we see of the drugs. Obviously, the atypical antipsychotics are 5-HT2A antagonists and 5-HT1A agonists, and this is why they probably work, in fact, for non-schizophrenia reasons. Procholinergic. The reason I didn't put cholinergic in here is because I've been trained for so long that when I hear cholinergic, I don't hear cholinergic. I hear anticholinergic. When I hear histamine, I don't hear histaminergic. I hear antihistaminergic. So procholinergic means it's stimulating cholinergic receptors. Who'd have thunk it? Who'd have thunk it? So the procholinergic treatment for positive symptoms exists now today. And it's because these new drugs, in one way or another, stimulate, or they're agonists, at one of the five cholinergic receptors. Now, I didn't have enough time to put those slides in. You look in the book and other places. There are five receptors. Two of them stimulate, and three of them inhibit. The M4 receptor lives on the presynaptic side, and the ones, threes, and fives live on the postsynaptic side. So when it's on the presynaptic side, here's the paradox. I'm going to say something out of both sides of my mouth. An agonist turns something off. What? An agonist stimulates an autoreceptor, and its job is, when stimulated, to stop release. So don't get confused, because this agonist is shutting things off. It's a stimulating agonist, but it's an M4 presynaptic receptor. Ladies and gentlemen, here's your to-do list. We've moved from the postsynaptic side to the presynaptic side. Learn what that means. We have moved from antagonists to agonists. Learn what that means. And we will actually give you some of them here, but those are some of the principles that are not automatically in our brain because we've lived in an antagonist world. Think of it. Essentially, all our drugs are antagonists. And what does that mean? You generally have to block almost all the receptors, whether it's an SSRI, a kind of an antagonist, or a D2 antagonist, and nothing much happens after that. With agonists, all sorts of weird stuff happens. First of all, if you engage some receptors of the agonist, nothing happens. There's no functional outcome. Second of all, if you engage only 10-20% of the receptors, you can get a clinical effect, whereas an antagonist, you've got to block the hell out of them. And there are other things about taking the signal from the synapse and the membrane into the cell. There's lots of roads. We used to think like cyclic AMP was the second messenger. That's so 1980s. There's like 20, maybe, pathways. Which one it chooses, God only knows why that happens. And when you have a drug which is not the same thing as the real thing, like an agonist for M4 is not acetylcholine. What acetylcholine does as an agonist and which signals it transduces is different than what a drug does. And we don't even know why that happens yet. Big difference from an antagonist, though. That's the point. So here's our friendly little pathway, and all of a sudden, Dr. Stahl drew in another nerve. Do you see it? It's in the brainstem, or hindbrain, you would call it. And who would have thought that the good Lord put that thing in there so that it would actually drive dopamine output, so much so that if you took away the drive from acetylcholine release there, it would stop psychosis. That's been there for as long as there's been human beings, and we only figured this out a few years ago. So what happens is this. Psychosis occurs, hypofunctional synapse, GABA gets sick, glutamate's too high, kick the butt of the direct innervation dopamine, it goes up, and you have psychosis, delusions, hallucinations, thought disorder. Now, I'm going to put this agonist on the north side of the synapse, because that's where the nerve receptor lives. There's no M4 on the south side of that synapse. Just the way it is. And it turns out that the way this is designed is they only go to the dopamine neurons that make you have psychosis. They don't go to the dopamine neurons that make you have motor side effects. I don't know why, but it was sure damn lucky. So if you go and you put an M4 agonist here, I'm not trying to confuse you, but you are turning off acetylcholine release. Acetylcholine release is kicking the butt of that blue nerve. If you stop the butt kicking, what's going to happen to the blue at the end of the psychosis circuit? Watch. And, you know, there may be other inputs to this circuit, but who would have thought that this one was that important? I mean, that's like crazy. And I don't know if you know the story of this. I'll tell you it quickly. A friend of mine, who you may know, is a very famous psychiatrist who's run drug companies for his career, Steve Paul. So they gave this drug, an M4 agonist. It's a little more complicated than that, but it does this. And it's also an M1 agonist. So I'll get to that in a second, but they thought the M1 agonist would make Alzheimer's patients think better. There's been this idea of stimulated acetylcholine in the brain, cholinergic loss, and blah, 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 blah. Okay, they gave it to Alzheimer's patients and didn't work that well. Kind of improved the cognition a bit, but it helped the psychosis. So they had this rocket science idea. Well, let's actually look and see if it changes psychosis and schizophrenia. And it did. Problem is, the drug that they did this with had a lot of side effects because it's not just an M1 and M4 agonist, it's also an M2 and an M3 agonist. When that happens, you have a lot of diarrhea and like all sorts of crap happening. I didn't mean to say that, but I guess it was really true, happening. And so it was complete serendipity. When they blocked the effects with an anticholinergic so that the procholinergic effects of this drug outside the brain were neutralized, then they could kick ass and take names and raise the dose and really hit the M4 agonist hard. Now you had M4 stimulation in the brain and no M2 stimulation outside of the brain, and you end up having a revolution, really. And now there is a cholinergic gold rush going on. I'm going to show you the slide. This is why you have to learn this stuff, because it ain't going away. The drug that did this is about to file with the FDA. They've done two positive trials, and they have to get a year's worth of work on it, safety, and then they're going to file it in a few months, and then it'll be a year after that we'll have it. So you're going to have to learn about this. You have to decide when you're going to use it, where it fits in your portfolio, and it reduces positive symptoms. So the role of procholinergic treatment in negative symptoms is also a possibility. This gets even more difficult, so if you don't want to listen for the next three slides, you don't have to. But it turns out that there's M1 receptors in the brain as well as M4. They're different places. They live in the cortex. The drug that was first described as an M4 agonist I was telling you about also has M1 action. So if you bind to M1 receptors where they live on those sick neurons I was telling you about, and they stimulate. Wow, if you could wake up the sick nerve in the cortex, maybe you would help the very thing I told you was the pathophysiology of schizophrenia. So let's see if that happens. This is a theory. You see that other little looping thing that's like a hook on it? I drew that in there. It's another pathway. So here is the cholinergic input, and I'm going to walk you through it again. Hypoactive, screwed up synapse. GABA doesn't work. Purple goes down. Red goes up. Purple goes up in the base, kicks the dopamine thing in an inhibitory way. Now you got negative and cognitive symptoms. Dum-da-da-dum! In comes the procholinergic M1 stimulating on the key neuron. Kick that sucker! Wake him up! Inhibit that glutamate hyperactivity. Stop that inhibition and make this done. I don't know if that's what happens, but that's the theory. So if you understand how the agonist modulators work, this is your job. Now I've got another set of to-do works. I'm sorry, I'm giving you terms. I'm turning into pharmacologist, but that's been my silent agenda for 15 years, so I'm not going to go away from that. Orthosteric doesn't mean orthopedic, it means regular. So the regular site is where the same drug goes, but also is where the neurotransmitter goes, okay? So I've just given you this drug. It's called xanomeline, if you care. And it's an orthosteric agonist. Why? Because it goes in the site where acetylcholine goes. There are a number of drugs called PAMs. Ladies and gentlemen, you have been doing PAMs. Anybody ever prescribed a Z drug hypnotic in the audience? Yeah? Any prescribed on those wicked, toxic benzodiazepines? I know you won't admit it, but I'm sure there are a lot of you who have done that. You've been prescribing PAMs the whole time because those are PAMs. Positive allosteric modulators. Now, they happen to work on the GABA. I'm going to show you one that works on the cholinergic. Orthosteric binds to the same site as endogenous agonist. KarXT, which is this fancy name because the company that made it is called Karuna. But xanomeline is the cholinergic agent, and trospium is the thing that they give to neutralize the crap outside the brain. It's an orthosteric agonist because it binds to M1 and M4, the same place that acetylcholine does. But they are not the only drugs in development. What's coming next after these guys are allosteric modulators. In fact, they're PAMs. That means, allo means other, steric means site. Allosteric, they bind to a different part of the receptor than where the natural neurotransmitter does, and makes it work mobeta. So the same thing, when a benzo binds to its allosteric site, it makes GABA work better for inhibition. You've known that for 20 years. It's the same thing only in the cholinergic receptor. In other words, allosteric binding modulates or changes the way the receptor works when something else binds to this orthosteric site. Why do you care? Because there's drugs coming out that are PAMs. There are three types of regular. There's mostly PAMs, which are positive allosteric modulators we're talking about. There's also, in addition to the ones that you know, there's NAMs, but we don't have any of those in medical care yet, but they're negative allosteric modulators. You might imagine if there's positive, it must be negative, but they're not clinically available and neutral. So nearly all current antipsychotic drugs are antagonists of dopamine serotonin receptors, right? Most reduce excessive dopamine neurotransmitter by blocking a large amount of postsynaptic receptors to keep them from being stimulated. Presynaptic agonists or modulators are believed to shut off neurotransmission. That has the downstream effect of stopping overstimulation of the dopamine neuron, reducing, therefore, the stimulation of the dopamine neuron, and then dopamine goes down and you live happily ever after. But unlike antagonists, agonists don't need to occupy the majority binding sites. Antagonists have to shut down all signal transduction, but that doesn't mean that agonists do the opposite. Agonists don't always enhance all the same signals that, and I'm going to show you an example of that in a couple of slides with the TAR stuff. They don't do the same thing as the natural neurotransmitter does. So, putting it all together on this part of the talk, both orthosteric and allosteric receptor sites can be linked to second messenger systems. Binding or modulating them can activate that system and exert downstream effects on one or more neurotransmitter systems without the pharmacological effects of potent antagonists. It has the same effect. Cholinergic neurons in the brain can play a role in regulating dopamine neurotransmission in a way we never thought before. Multiple cholinergic agonists and PAMs are being developed. Here they are. The dopamine hypothesis is the major theory. The M4 agonist binding on the presynaptic side, this was one of your pretest questions, the M4 agonist binding on the presynaptic side shuts off the activation of hyperactive mesolimbic dopamine neurons, reducing positive symptoms. M4 agonist, presynaptic, cholinergic, shuts off dopamine neurons, makes positive symptoms better. I'll say it again. M4 agonist, presynaptic side, stops overactivation of dopamine neurons, reduce negative symptoms. Okay, you're getting it. So the M4 inhibition of interneuron activity also decreases cholinergic tone. The M1, we're not going to spend a lot of time on that, but it's working in the cortex to maybe help cognitive symptoms or negative symptoms. Here's the agents. This is why you got to know. There's a gold rush. Here it is. Karuna's KarXT. I don't even know they got a name for it yet. It's an M1, M4 central agonist with an M2, M3 peripheral antagonist. Cerevel has a drug company. These are, if you want to talk to these companies, are all here. M Raclidine is an M4 PAM. It's in phase two. Neurocrine has a phase two M4 agonist. And Acadia has an M1 PAM. So watch out, it's coming your way. You've heard it here first. Xanomeline is the first one you'll see. It's part of the drug called KarXT. It has a bunch of activity in the brain at M1 and M4. Some of these other things that it binds to, it binds in a non-functional way. So it actually has serotonin binding, but it doesn't really have serotonin activity. But in a surprising way, it decreased dopamine. Nobody would have thunk it. Nobody would have thunk it. Now, this is also something nobody would have thunk. Tracemines. What the hell is a tracemine? It's not there very much. It's not stored in a synaptic vesicle. It's not a neurotransmitter. What the heck is it doing there? We didn't know. Tracemines have been known since the 1800s. In fact, do you know who uses tracemines the most? Your gut bacteria. Bacteria use them as neurotransmitters. Most of your tracemines are right here in your bowels. So nobody thought this was going to be anything important. So what is a tracemine? It's a form when one of the enzymes doesn't work that makes the normal neurotransmitters you've come to know and love. I will show you. So it's either when tyrosine hydroxylase doesn't act on something, or tryptophan. So here's the pictures. If you look at the phenethylamine at the top, PEA and paratyramine, those are the big ones in a human. If you look at dopamine and norepinephrine just below it, look how close they are. They're missing a hydroxyl group or two. That's the only reason. So what the heck are they doing there? There's five of them. Really, the main ones that we need to think about are PEA and tyramine. And there's six tracemine receptors, but only one of them is important for humans, really, TAR1. So they live in parts of the brain where the monoamines live. So if the receptors are there, the tracemines must be there. And if the receptors are there and the tracemines be there, they must be doing something for a living. What the heck are they doing? So let's take a look at the dopamine side. It does stuff. Some people think there are rheostats. If it's too low, it raises activity. If it's too high, it lowers it. So the tracemine receptor is in the place where schizophrenia lives, the too much high activity dopamine neuron in the VTA. And I'm going to show you a very cool and novel way to stop hyperactive dopamine with never touching a D2 receptor directly with a drug. What? It's because you've gone upstream in the psychosis circuit. And I'm not going to show you all this, but I will tell you briefly that if you increase TAR activity with an agonist, which is what we're doing with a new drug, you'll decrease dopamine neurotransmission. And of course, if you decrease TAR, you'll increase it. It also has, briefly, some effects on serotonin. I'm not going to mention this, except I've got a new word for you. Two words on your to-do list from this last part of the lecture. Heterodimerization and biased agonism. So you can heterodimerize serotonin, but I'm not going to waste my time on that. I'm going to talk about heterodimerizing in the dopamine system. And finally, TAR1s can regulate glutamate in ways that are still not as well understood as the dopamine I'm going to show you now. Da-da-da-da! Enter the new story. Both PEA and tyramine are synthesized in dopamine terminals. They're not stored in synaptic vesicles. And they diffuse across plasma membranes, so when the nerve fires, they don't get released. They just kind of journey on out whenever the hell they want to. I don't know how that happens. There's no reuptake pump for them, but there's this other weird pump called an organic cation transporter type 2, and some of them may be postsynaptic as well, to re-suck them back up and have them roam around in the cytoplasm again. They're mostly intracellular, both pre- and postsynaptic, and there's an idea that the TAR1, when activated, prevents dopamine hyperactivity. So that TAR1 agonists are a theoretically novel way to prevent overactivity by D2 receptors and change glutamate. So TAR1 may heterodimerize. Before I tell you this, I'm going to say this stuff happened by accident, which is why I believe it. What really happened? A little company called Sepracor was actually acquired by another company called Sunovion. And they found all these old drugs on the shelves. They didn't know what the heck they did. So their chief of medicine there said, let's put them in this thing called a smart cube. And it was this stuff where you put rats in this thing, pumped them full of the drug, and see how they behave. And the smart cube said, this stuff acts like an antipsychotic. So they put it in testing, it didn't block dopamine receptors, and they didn't really know what it did. They looked and looked and looked for things, but they said, what the hell, we'll put it in man. So they did safety, it was safe, they put it in man, and lo and behold, man was like a rat. I know politicians are like rats, but I didn't know that man was like a rat. So it was serendipitous. And then later they found, going through everything, said they went find down the fine print of all the things that people look at when a drug's bind. They went tracheamine. Who ever heard of these people? It was a tracheamine agonist. They're going like, holy crap, what's this? And so what I'm telling you now is going to sound very elegant, but it was post hoc. This is completely accidental that you found out that a tracheamine was an antipsychotic. Now we not know how it could work. It makes sense, but it didn't make sense because we targeted this on purpose. We targeted this on accident. It's a little bit like the old days when tuberculosis drugs were used to treat tuberculosis, and some of them got better from their depression in the sanitariums in the Swiss Alps, and they found out, oh, it's also an MAO inhibitor. That was an accident. I believe in accidents. But the TAR1, when you bind it, I'm going to show you a cartoon of this, it translocates to the cell surface after heterodimerization. It's basically one receptor hugs another, and when it does it, it changes the output of the receptor. It touches, and the two proteins hug each other. And when that happens, it biases the signal to a certain way. I'm going to show you this. And it does it both presynaptic and postsynaptically. And the TAR1 heterodimers with, that's a new term for you, heterodimers, with D2 receptors, positively modulates the D2 autoreceptors. What is that? Why do you care about that? Because this is why it's an antipsychotic. It stops dopamine synthesis and release. Oh my God. That's another way not to have too much dopamine. You can block the hell out of all the receptors, or you can have not enough dopamine released in the first place. That's what this does. So how does it do it? There's your TAR1 up and above. It's going to hit that TAR1 receptor. Dopamine normally has an autoreceptor. This is a little bit, I was talking about the M4 receptor. Well, the D2 receptor, actually, when dopamine itself occupies it, it will tell the brain, stop making dopamine. Because that's the idea. It's a break. When the dopamine builds up in the synaptic cleft, it stops dopamine. So when TAR comes in, whoop, you see that? Here it came in, whoop. And now I'm going to heterodimerize. It's not actually a sex act, so don't be mad. Heterodimer, whoop, there it is, it heterodimerized. And now I'm going to bias my agonism away from beta arrestin and biasing it to the G inhibitory side. Why do you care? Because that's gonna go up there and say, tyrosine hydroxylase, you stop working. You stop making dopamine. You stop synthesizing and releasing dopamine. And now the dopamine receptor there is no longer bombarded and you have no psychosis. Wow. May happen on the postsynaptic side as well. So there's two in development. I'm gonna have to skip this because time is short here. It'll be in my slide deck, but there's one that Roche has. It's one of the phases didn't work right, and there's this drug elotronant, which is actually in phase 3 and will be filed if the next trial is successful. You can talk to the companies about these, but the one called Rolmiterant is in phase 2. It's actually doing either monotherapy versus placebo, looking at negative symptoms, or add-on versus non-add-on for negative symptoms, and that's still in process. This one over here is the one that's further along, Lulotronant. It's also got some 5-HT1A receptor, but it don't do nothing to the D2 receptors. And it really had an amazing 4-week study, which has been published. I'm gonna show you also the 26 label extension, and it's now in phase 3, including adolescents. So here's the outcome. This is the PANSS score, and the blue line's placebo, and it separated from placebo at week 3, and the effect size was whopping 0.45. It's a big size. It was a little later than some antipsychotics work, but some work at 3 and 4 weeks as well. And also, if you look at the positive symptom and the negative symptom subscale, it worked in both. And quickly, do you see EPS on this? No. Do you see weight gain on this? No. What do you see? Almost nothing. They had some minor side effects. It's like you couldn't even believe it. I mean, weight decreased in some patients. In fact, they've put this out in patients that don't even have schizophrenia, or at least animal models, and it looks like it actually is good for patients with weight gain. So the serious side effects are completely turned upside down. No Parkinsonism, dyskinesia, tremor, or weight gain. So, pretty good. So the long term, look at this, the weight gain and the BMI change. Have you seen this with an antipsychotic recently? Have you seen that change in cholesterol like that? Amazing. So, in summary, ladies and gentlemen, I gave you a to-do list. We can understand the underlying neurocircuitry based upon our old drugs. And on the basis of that, we can move to the new drugs, because we know how first generations work, we know how second generations work, and now, hopefully, we can draw in a new color of a cholinergic receptor or a tracheamine receptor to actually show how this works. And so I think these will address unmet needs in schizophrenia in terms of residual symptoms and certainly medication side effects. We don't know if they're going to work better or worse or whether you're going to add them on. That's all for the future.